All right. So this week's Parashat Noah, really divides into two basic sections, two main stories. The predominant story of the Parashah is Noah and the flood, and the Teva, and the sort of. I don't know.
Is it
a thing? I feel like everyone just notices when it rains on Shabbat Noah. Oh, it's raining on Shabbat Noah. Yeah. No, my twins had their sebit when they were born, Parashat Noah, because my mother wanted to do 2x2. That was like her thing. That was her theme, and it was very nice and sunny, so it didn't rain. So, but everyone was like, "Oh, it's gonna rain."
Right. Yeah.
And the second main story of the Parashah is the story of the Tower of Babel, the Migdal Babel, it's a very short story, but it's a very famous one, and people know a lot about it. And then, sort of in between some of these stories, we get a lot of what they call genealogies, like just this person gave birth to this, and all fathers and sons, and tracing the repopulation of the world. So what I want to do today is I want to focus on that story of Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babel. It's really only 9 verses, it's only 9 pesukim in the Torah, but it's a fascinating 9 pesukim. And there's a ton of stuff that's there that we have to sort of unpack and sort of figure out what it is that's going on. It's an incredibly short story, and it's a very cryptic story. It's very difficult. It's like a puzzle. You got to try to piece it together. Now, we have a lot of knowledge of this when we study it in grade school and when we're young. And so we think we may maybe know the story 100%. But what I want us to do is to really read the verses. I have them for you in English and in Hebrew. And what I want you to keep in mind as we're reading it is, what is the sin of these people? What did they do wrong? We automatically come with this feeling that they did something wrong, and there's a lot of evidence to support that. But what is it that they did wrong, and how do we know for sure that they did something wrong? We're going to read the verses, and if you see anything that you think might be a hint to us or what they did wrong, so then, you know, feel free to shout it out and to say it, and then we'll sort of break it down and look at it as a whole, and we'll give some of the commentaries what they classically say. So the story begins with the following words: Vayhi kol ha'aretz safa echat. The earth had the same language. Udvarim ahadim. And again, the word echad is a key word here. One, the same words or unified words. In other words, everybody was sort of condensed, speaking the same language. Same words to describe things. Vahi benos amikedem in the second pasuk, it was when they migrated from the east. Vayimtzeu bik'ah, they found a valley be'eretz Shinar, in this land called Shinar. Vayeshvu sham, and they sat there, they lived there, they dwelled there. Vayomeru, they said ish el re'ehu, each person to his friend. Hava nilbena levinim, let us make bricks. V'nisrefa lisrefa, and burn them. To create them, you know, a concrete structure. V'tehi lahem halevina le'avin. The brick became for them stone. V'hachemar, and the tar, I guess you could say, haya lahem lahom. It became their mortar or their concrete that they used to stick things together. So this is the first recorded building project that anybody's going to make. They create for themselves the building materials that they need to be able to make the project work. And so everything seems to be going the right way. Vayomeru, and again they said to each other, Hava nivne lanu ir, let us come and build for ourselves a city, umigdal, and a tower, v'rosho b'shamayim, and its peak will be in the sky, in the heavens, v'na'asen lanu shem, and we'll make a name for ourselves, pen nafutz al pene kol ha'aretz, lest we end up being scattered over the entire land. So already you could see where the irony is. The whole point of the building project was so that they don't end up being scattered all over the land. We know that God is going to sort of mock them with this. Pasuk Hey, the fifth verse. Vayered Adonai, God comes down. Lir'ot et ha'ir ve'et ha'migdal, to see the city and the tower. Asher banu b'nei ha'adam, that the children of man have built. And what does he say? Vayomer Adonai, God says, Hen am echad, they're one nation, v'safa ahat lekulam, and one language to everybody, v'zeh achilam la'asot, and this is how they have begun to act. V'ata lo yibatzer lehem, nothing that they are proposing to do, kol asher yazimu la'asot, that I'm not going to let any of the things that they want to happen over here, whatever their goals are, I'm not going to let them come to fruition. Was there more papers? You could take one of those if you want. No, for you. Oh, you have one. Oh, okay. I didn't see. Okay, no problem. Kol asher yazimu la'asot. So Hashem is saying, I have to block these plans. I'm not going to let them to accomplish what they want. Hava nereda. Let us go down. Ve'navela sham sefatam. And we'll mix up their languages. Asher lo yishme'u ish sefat re'ehu. So that each person cannot hear or understand the language of his friend. And in fact, that's what happens. Vayafet Adonai otam misham. God scatters them out from that place, al pene kol haaretz, over the course of the land. Vayahdelu livnot ta'ir. And as a result, the building project goes south. They're unable to finish building their city and their tower. Al ken, for this reason, kara shema Bavel. They called the name of this place where it originated, Bavel, from the word mixed up. Kisham balal. God mixed up Adonai sefat kol haaretz, the language of all of the land. Umisham hefitzam Adonai, from there God scattered them, al pene kol haaretz, over the entire face of the earth. That's it. That's what the Torah tells us in 9 verses. We get this description of the world, what's going on, one language, one people. We see what they plan to do. They come to this valley, they want to build a tower and a city. God comes down, says, I'm not so happy with what's happening over here. Let's do this instead. He scatters them around, and they get scattered all over the land, and we end up with a place called Bavel because of that. So,
this is the whole Bavel story?
This is the whole thing. All this 9 Pesukim, and this is all the Torah tells us about it. Now, going through your mind, Sophie, is probably, wait a minute, I have a lot of other things that I know, right? So, and you're not seeing a lot of this here. And that's probably because you're already thinking about some of the commentaries and some of the midrashim that are mentioned about this text. But before we take a look at that and that approach, you're kind of sitting there going like, oh, okay, like what's going on over here? What did they do wrong? What is God doing? How does the quote unquote punishment fit the crime? How are things sort of shaping up here? So what is it that they did wrong? If anything, yeah. Okay, so that you're translating what you're saying is that Rosho Bashamayim is the problem over here. That was their intent to do what?
Like to be like equivalent to God.
Okay, I like that a lot.
And then I think the other thing I remember was something about that there was a problem with having the same language and the same words. In other words, that it's almost like you're not challenging yourself. It's like you're just one entity. Even like a man and a wife, like that's mm-hmm. why, you know, you're different and you come together to.
Saying we want people with these differences to necessarily be. You think it's too easy?
Yeah, and there's no growth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an interesting one. I would have said I think most people when they look at this would probably have viewed that concept as a positive, right? We're always talking about unity and bringing people together and wow, look at this building project that they want to do. It's so hard to get anybody to be on the same page today. But what you're suggesting is that maybe God wasn't happy with that aspect.
Maybe the stagnant part of it.
Uh-huh. So if that's correct, I like your first part about the Rosh HaShemayim, and we're going to play on that a little bit. If your second theory is correct, so then I have one problem. The problem is, why does God wait to scatter them over the land until after they decide to build this city and the tower? If what we're saying is correct, I would have expected God to say, you know, this is how ideally I want it to be. I want people to be different. I want people to be all over so that they can find ways to grow and come together. Why does God wait until after the story of the tower and the city to then scatter them around? You see my question?
I do, because I think when it says in Pasuk Vav that if this is how you're going to act, if I give you one people and one language, meaning you're not doing it to the best of its potential, then I'm going to do the opposite.
So meaning one...
You're not playing well with the blessings I'm giving you.
So what would have been playing well? Like what was God hoping for? Uh-huh. So it comes back, right, so in the end of the day, it comes back to that same, meaning, if they united on the project for a proper purpose, then God would have been happy with that. It really seems to be that the purpose of why they're building it is what then God says, the fact that they're all united together and they're uniting in this negative purpose is no good. So the answer to that would be, scatter them out so that they're unable to unite for this negative purpose.
Maybe.
Okay, I like that. Any other thoughts or theories here about what they did wrong?
Was it positive?
Is what positive?
When they were made, what? Is this a positive? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know. You tell me.
I don't know.
You're saying, is the story a positive one or is it a negative one?
Negative.
Huh?
No, we know it as negative. We know
it's like causing, like, isn't it like, there's something, I forgot where it's related, but something like you could make things, you could stop a fire or you could create a fire. Like, they made it a thing, right?
They made it negative.
What? They made what? Meaning?
They made it like a, they made it bad.
They made it. They turned it.
Right. So they took something what we would probably assume is positive, which is unity, and they turned it into a negative because of what they did. Mm-hmm. But the problem then that I have is if we're bothered with the purpose of their unity, so then why is the quote unquote punishment then to scatter them? It should have been that God said, okay, I don't like what you're doing here. I love that you're unified, but I don't like what you're doing here. So I'm going to keep you unified, but just stop doing this. But that's not what God does. God scatters them. It seems like the unity is not something that God can sort of live with. So we're kind of...
Were they doing other things?
We don't know. This is the only... The Torah doesn't give us a ton of information.
Unity altogether.
Maybe it wasn't negative.
Yeah, maybe they were, you know... stronger as numbers together, and they weren't doing positive things. So
okay.
It wasn't just the tower.
Well, what was some of those? Okay, so but now what we're doing is that could be a theory, but the problem is that we got to build it off of the text that the Torah gives to us, and the Torah doesn't give us, at least at face value, any info about if they were doing something like that. Right? We're not 100%. We're not 100% sure. So you could see where some of the issues here lie in trying to figure out what it is. Now, many of us might be familiar with a very common idea about Migdal Bavel. This is courtesy of Jack Zolta, right? Who says that, that you know, what?
Dor
HaPlaga, right? This is what they call it. Dor HaPlaga, right? The concept of, you could see, we really have two stories. If you compare this story to the flood story, so what's the flood story? The flood story is there's a lot of tension, there's corruption man to man, right? There's Hamas, there's stealing, there's murder, there's all terrible things going on man to man. God obliterates them, he wipes it out. Here, there's unity. God deals with it in a much different way, a much more lenient way. So a lot of people try to draw out a lesson from here, and it's a very, very, very good lesson, which is God is less... harsh when people try to go against him, attack him, Rosh HaBashamayim, than he is when people try to go against their fellow man, right? Fellow man, God says, I have no tolerance for that. We got to start over. Wipe everybody away. We got to start again. Here, it seems like they're good with each other, at least at face value. Their problem seems to be vis-a-vis God, and so God says, okay, we got to solve this problem, but he doesn't obliterate the whole generation the way he does with the flood. Now you could say, well, that's because he promised he wasn't going to, but I don't know, maybe he could find another way. It seems like God deals with these people in a much different way. But you could see that the text of the Torah is very shorthanded and doesn't give us a tremendous amount of information about it, and so the reader is still left wondering. So I want to give to you a couple of very famous theories that are mentioned by a lot of the commentaries and even by our rabbis in the Midrashim, many of which you're probably familiar with. I want to see if we're okay with these or if we think that they follow with the text of the Torah. The first midrash is well known, that they wanted to build the tower so they can go up to heaven and fight against God. They wanted to wage war with God. This was their thought process. That's one mention that Rashi brings it over there. They wanted to wage war against God. Well, that has some issues. What might be some of our problems with that midrash? And this is, by the way, I guarantee you, if you ask any of your children, that's going to be the first explanation that they're going to give you. That's what they learn in school. Huh? Right. So they learn the problem. They learn, because Rashi brings it, and it's a famous midrash, they went to fight against God, physically fight against him. Now that has some problems now. If we go a little more, take that midrash and try to sophisticate it up. Huh? Right, and we would assume that the people understand this fact, right? The people of this generation are not dumb. And to think that a large group of people would get together for such an act seems very illogical, seems very, very strange. And so it's likely that what the rabbis are telling us with fight against God is not a literal fight against God. It's probably more of a metaphoric sense that the rabbis are trying to illustrate for us over here. And so we might have to come back to that in a little bit, and maybe we'll try to give something, a deeper explanation to what the rabbis saw in this passage that led them to give it in that way, to kind of dress it up that way. That's one approach to this issue. A second approach that they say was that the tower was for the purposes of avodah zarah. It was for the purposes of idol worship. And they wanted to deny the existence of God and idol worship. Ah, great question, right? Where do we see? We didn't see anything that seemed to hint to idol worship. Now, what's very interesting here is most of the time when we have things like this with the rabbis, we usually have a problem with trying to make history or archaeology and things that we find match up with what the rabbis say. But it's amazing to see that in this case, archaeology seems to prove exactly what the rabbis said. That in fact, if you go to modern day Babylonia, which is modern day Iraq and things like that, you'll find remnants of gigantic towers. They've found already 30. They've excavated almost 30 different towers like this. What they call in fancy English a ziggurat. A ziggurat is like a stepping platform kind of tower, which was clearly used for the purposes of idol worship. It was a temple dedicated to their gods with inscriptions and all kinds of writings. And in some of them they find the inscription of to the heavens. In other words, that they want to build it to the heavens. And so it's amazing to see that the rabbis kind of got it right when you look at their historical perspective. They seem to have it right in terms of identifying this as one of those things that they're going up to heaven. The problem is that the Torah doesn't identify it that. So we have the rabbis who seem to be very much in tune, in a rare scenario, I would say, with archaeology and history. A lot of times we struggle with this. The archaeology doesn't prove necessarily what the Torah does or what the rabbis say. And we have to kind of try to mesh it together. But here, it seems like the rabbis were very historically accurate. The question is, why doesn't the Torah then come out and say it? Why doesn't the Torah say they wanted to build this temple, Migdal, to the gods? It doesn't. The Torah seems to kind of hide that fact. So there's an issue with that approach and that explanation. That's number two. I'll do one more. The third explanation that is given is very novel from the Ibn Ezra and the Ralbag. They say there is nothing negative about this story. It's actually not a negative story. They didn't do anything wrong. They didn't do anything wrong. God said, I want you to be scattered so that you could populate the earth. In other words, man came out of the Teva and naturally gravitated to small communities to be together, to live on top of each other. And God said, this is not going to work for me because I need the world to be populated. I need man to spread out. The only way to do that, the way to get men to spread out, was to have them not be able to understand each other, was to sort of find a way to divide the people so that they'll migrate away from each other. How did he do that? He mixed up their languages. If as long as everybody's speaking the same language, they're all going to stay together. But people will naturally migrate to communities that speak the same language. They can understand each other. So he made them all different languages. Naturally, people spread out into different regions. And by that doing that, now the world can be populated and everybody can live happily ever after. So the Ibn Ezra says, there's really nothing negative here. The Torah is giving us a story about how we got to the current situation where people are populated the earth. Now, a lot of faces changed on that one, and I agree with that. What's the difficulty with that theory?
Did they destroy the tower, like right then and there?
It doesn't say that they destroyed the tower. It says, Vayahdelu livnot ha'ir, that they stopped building the city. So it seems like they had started the project, something had gone up, because God says, let me go down and see the city and the tower. So they probably got things started, but at some point, because of what God does, the building project ends.
From all the stories, usually when Hashem is upset, he destroys it. Like Sodom, like the earth.
There's no indication of destruction over here.
So maybe the third one's correct.
Okay, so maybe the fact that there's no destruction and maybe in the eyes of the Ibn Ezra, the punishment, if we even want to call it that in his eyes, is a very mitigated punishment compared especially to what we just read with the flood. He's looking at it and saying, I don't really see a punishment here. The fact that they got scattered, that's probably a benefit for them. Now they can populate the world, they can trade, they can go to different areas. It's a good thing, not a negative thing. That's sort of the Ibn Ezra's. The difficulty with this, I think, is it seems like God is not happy with what's going on over here. Statements like, they're one people, v'zeh ha'chilam la'asod, this is what they started to do. I'm not going to allow them to continue what they thought to do. It sounds like a very negative connotation on the part of God, and God says, let's go down and mix them up so that this can't happen again. So it does seem that if you're reading the story, the Torah is kind of painting it with a little bit of a negative perspective.
I think when you read the first, it's negative.
Which one? That the land is all together?
No, everyone on earth had the same. They didn't feel, uh-huh. feel like they're saying man in a negative way.
How?
I don't know. It just looks negative, like they shouldn't be.
Uh-huh. But is that because of what we're used to, maybe in our own perspective, the way we're looking at it? I could hear that. That's I'm sorry, I don't know.
Jenny.
That's sort of where Jenny was going with it. That like we would look at it, looking from our perspective, we might say, I don't know how much I don't know how great the world would be like that. You know, imagine that we had this kind of situation. I don't know how thrilled I would be with that. So there's a lot of theories here, but each of them seem to have some holes in them. Right? Some questions. Yeah.
So, I mean, I just realized when it says same language and same words, that seems like repetitive.
Safa ahad and dvarim ahadim.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. The words dvarim ahadim are difficult to kind of explain. The commentaries really grapple with that. Here they translated same words. What I would say is that sometimes people have the same language, meaning they speak the same words, but they'll use two different words to describe a thing.
Right?
You know what I mean? So the idea is not only... Huh? It seems like the world is somewhat in their infancy. The Torah gives us, after Noah comes out of the Teva, the Torah gives us one section of genealogy, which is maybe, I forget offhand, about not even a ton of generations, maybe two or three generations, and then the Torah gets into this story. So it doesn't seem like there's a tremendous... We don't know, Bereshit is a kind of hard timetable. After this story, the Torah gives us the 10 generations between Noah and Abraham. That's when it comes right after the story, and then we get into the story of Abraham, and we're gonna play on that a little bit as well. But that's sort of what's happening over here. How much time? I'm not sure. Is the door not open?
It's open. It's hard.
It's hard to. Okay, so I want to give to you two ideas. One is I want to present to you the Abarbanel, Rav Yitzhak Don Abarbanel, is a Spanish hacham. His approach in the 1300s. His approach to this story, it's an interesting one. I have a feeling it might spark a little bit of conversation and controversy, which is always fun. And then I want to give to you maybe a little bit more of a message kind of approach, which is Rabbi Sachs's approach to this, and it's going to connect to the highlighted words that you may have been noticing in the text that I sort of gave you. If you want to pass a sheet so that you can look inside. So the Abarbanel...
Hebrew and English.
The Abarbanel posits the following theory. He says, the sin of the Tower of Babel is the same sin of Adam, and it's the same sin of Cain. It's the same thing that's going on and repeating itself over and over again. What is that sin? The lack of being content with what God gives you. Adam is placed in Gan Eden, and the commandment, this is a question on your students' parasha, if you have any middle school students, this is a question on their parasha test. What was the commandment that God gave to Adam and Hava in Gan Eden? What was it?
Don't touch on the tree.
No, incorrect.
Don't eat from the fruit of the tree.
No. Everybody misses the first part, which is the main part. The first thing that God said, it says, Vaitzav.
Everything is yours.
Good, very good. The pasuk says, Vaitzav et Adam. He commands the Adam and he tells him, Mikol etz hagan achol tochel. You shall eat from all of the fruits. In other words, the first commandment is phrased first in the positive. Eat from all of the fruits. That's a commandment. It's not a, we generally, in our minds, we said that, oh, we're allowed to eat. No, no, no. He tells him, eat from the fruits. It's a commandment. Enjoy from the fruits. Eat from that which I've told you. Just ume'etz hada'at tovara lo tochal mimenu. Don't eat from this tree. In other words, 99.9% of the things allowed. Eat. I want you to eat. Enjoy. I want you to have good.
Hashem never said it like, you can't have this, but you can have everything else.
It was the opposite way. Eat positively first. Then he tells him, just stay away from here. So this is a very different way of thinking about it. In other words, God's putting the good first and then telling you, just stay away from that. And now it's very simple. God's telling him, be content. I'm giving you 99.9% of everything. Be happy with it. Human beings, we're not happy unless we have 100%. We have to have everything. And that was Adam and Hava's first issue, which is we want the forbidden fruit. We want the thing that we can't have. And we push ourselves to do it. So God says, you want the thing that you can't have? Guess what? You're going to have to work very hard for the thing that you can't have. So now the land is cursed, and you're going to have to work very hard to get that stuff out of the ground for you to do it. Punishment measure for measure. Cain, the same thing. You want to be the head, and you're not content with what you have. God says, don't worry about what Hevel got. Hevel, I took his korban. Just do better yourself and I'll take yours. No, it wasn't enough for Cain. God has to take mine and not take my brother's. I'm jealous of my brother. And so he kills his brother. Time and again, man is not content with what he has with God. He says that's the same thing over here. The people came to the valley and they had everything that they needed. They came out of the Teva. They were good. God told them, multiply, start over again. Everything was fine. God said, I'll provide for you. Everything's going to be good for you. Now you can even eat the animals. You have another source of food. All good. What did they say? Not enough for us. What do? They say, let us have a nilbena levinim. They try to create a new form of building material, which at face value seems like a positive thing. Well, they want to make construction. Says that by balance, a negative thing. They had enough. They had sufficient means for shelter that would suffice for them. They wanted something better. So what do? They create the bricks. They create the cement. We can create something even massive, even larger. They say, let's build a city. Let's build a tower. They didn't need any of these things. They were perfectly content and had enough to be able to live and do everything that they needed. And then the rest of the time, they'd be able to connect with God. They'd be able to be spiritual, moral people. No. We want more. We want to push the envelope. We want to invent. We want to push. We want to go. And all of that leads them to the point where God says, no. You're going down the wrong path because you're going to get so bogged down by all of these things. Interesting, God does a little bit of comedy play over here. What do they say? They say, we want to get the thing, Rosho Bashamayim. What happens? Vayered Adonai. God goes down, almost mocking them, saying, you think you can get it all the way up to the sky? I have to come down to be able to see what it is that you're building. You can't get to this point. And so they constantly push the envelope. And God says, be happy with what you have. And so God says, this is not going to work. I need to stop the project here and scatter them to sort of have the product of Vayahtelu Livnotair. They're not going to be able to do this building project anymore. And now they're going to have to work even harder to be able to globalize the world and to have all of their luxuries that they want. Essentially, the Abarbanel, in summary, looks at this as a polemic, as a critique on luxuries, on trying to push your way to have so much more. Notice he puts a little interesting idea in verse 5, Pasuk Hey. It says that God goes down to see the tower and the city, Asher Banu Beneha Adam, that the children of Adam built. That's a very strange phrase. Why do they call Beneha Adam? Just say, Asher Banu Ha'anashim, or the people, or whatever you want to call them. What is Beneha Adam? It's hinting to that, says the Abarbanel, that they're the children of Adam. In other words, the same thing that Adam did, that's what these guys are going ahead and doing. And so that is the Abarbanel's sort of take on this as a critique against, if we could say it this way, and this is going to make everyone feel a little uncomfortable, against technology, against advancing with human progression to things that we don't need. Yeah. Right.
We want to create cures to things, and then Vinay is saying we should be content with those.
So I think it's a good question. When I read this Abarbanel for the first time, I was very excited about the explanation because I thought it fit very nicely. And then when I stopped and thought about some of the ramifications of what the Abarbanel might be saying, it made me feel a little bit of a pit in my stomach. Like, so what are we trying to say? Are we saying that coming up with these inventions is not a good thing to try and improve our lives and whatnot? Like, what is it that Abarbanel is trying to critique? And so I think that my understanding is that he's trying to tell you luxuries that are there to enhance our pleasure in the world and things that we don't necessarily need is where he's saying that the critique lies. They didn't need this. It enhanced their life, maybe. It made them feel a lot more comfortable. It made them feel physically better. Right. Right. So in the end of the day, the world now functions based on this, right? The world uses this. We're all building homes. We're all picking up where it is. But I think the critique here is that No, I don't think that the Torah is telling you don't invent cures for diseases. That's a positive thing that can allow human beings to survive. That's, I would say, it's part of necessity. But there are certain things that we can maybe each pinpoint in our lives that, do I really 100% need this, right? Or is this making my life more complicated, or is it making my life less complicated? I think we could all agree in today's modern world, I think this rings even more true, is that there are some things that we look as, oh, technology, but they make our lives even more complicated than they were before, right? Once upon a time, a husband got home from work at 7 o'clock and he was done, yeah, right? It was over. Am I hitting a buzz point here? I don't know, right? That's it. The day was over and they got home and it was kids and it was family and it was this. So email now, wow, we can do more work, but it complicates our lives. Now we get home at 7:30 and we're still checking emails. We're still answering calls. We're still connecting to China. We're still talking about this. So it may have helped us from the standpoint of work, but it complicated our lives. Whereas before that, we were fine. We were okay. Right? There was an end to the day. And in fact, we were happier. We were better off. We felt more comfortable. So, you know, we didn't know what was going on there. So sometimes we bring in the technology and sometimes it becomes a problem. And sometimes it complicates our lives more than it actually enhances us. So I think what the message, the takeaway from the Abarbanel's perspective is...
More wound up than we were.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. How come our kids are... When we were kids, we played outside all day long and now our kids are... Well... You know, some of those, right, what's next? And they can't relax. So I think that's a very, very interesting idea from the Abarbanel that we could sort of take out from this story. I want to give you one last idea, and this is the idea of Rabbi Sachs and also Rabbi Menachem Liebtag on this particular thing, and it connects to some of the buzzwords. Take a look at the Psukim again. I highlighted some repetitive words. And this is a good technique anytime you're studying Chumash in a little bit of depth, is to look at words that seem to keep appearing. When the Torah has something to say, it doesn't say it all the time right out. It expects the reader to notice that there are patterns in the text. Words keep repeating themselves. So the words kol ha'aretz keep repeating themselves throughout the parasha. In the first verse, vahi kol ha'aretz, go to the fourth verse, Pen nafutz, they say, lest we scattered al penek kol ha'aretz, on the face of all of the land. In the eighth verse, God scatters them al penek kol ha'aretz. And in the ninth verse, kisham balal Adonai sefat kol ha'aretz, the whole land. Umisham hefitam Adonai, God scattered them al penek kol ha'aretz. Five times in nine verses, the Torah uses the phrase kol ha'aretz. That's supposed to send a message to the reader. Those are important words. Let's leave that on the side for a second. Another word that keeps appearing are the letters Shin Mem, which could be either Shem, a name, or Sham, a place, or the first two letters of the word Shamaim, heavens. So look again. In the second verse, Vayeshvu Sham, they dwell there in the valley. On Pasuk Dalet, V'na'aseh lanu Shem, will have a name. In Pasuk Zayin, the seventh verse, V'navela sham sefatam, we will scatter, we will mix up their languages over there. V'yafetz Adonai otam misham, he scattered them from there. Alken kara shema, its name was called Bavel. Kisham, because over there, Balal Adonai sefat kol ha'aretz, he mixed all of them up. U'misham hefitzam Adonai, and from there he scattered. The words sham, shem, shamayim, keep repeating themselves eight times in just a very short amount of verses. What am I trying to illustrate by that? What does Rabbi Sachs illustrate from this? The Torah is connecting you back to Bereshit, to the beginning. Eretz and Shamayim. Bereshit bara Elohim, et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. The Torah is saying that what's happening here is trying to undo what God did when He created the world. When God created the world, He created it as Shamayim ve-aretz. He what? He separated. The word that keeps coming up over and over again in creation is Vayavdil. God separates things. When things are separated from each other, there's order, there's a balance, there's peace. Things have a place. They know where they're supposed to go. They have a role and a job to perform, and they fulfill it and obey it successfully. What do the people of this parasha want to do? They're trying to merge the two. They're trying to blur the lines of separation between heaven and earth. They're saying, let's make a name for ourselves. We're going to overtake this name of God. We're not going to allow God to separate Shamayim and Aretz. We're going to build a tower and we're going to go all the way up to the Shamayim. What were they saying by that? They were trying to say, we're not accepting the dominion of God over us. We're in control, and we're not just in control of the land. We're also in control of the heavens. We're also going to take over the heavens. That's what the rabbis, I believe, meant when they said that they built the tower to fight against God. What were they trying to do? We want to be the God. We want to be the rulers, the ones who determine what's going to happen. We're not going to have someone who sits up there tell us what we need to do down here. We're in control of everything. So we're going to make a Shem for ourselves. We're going to make a Sham. We're going to make a place for ourselves. The Aretz is going to be ours. The Shamayim is going to be ours. And that's going to be who we are. We're going to overtake everything. Those are some of the hidden messages that the Torah is trying to put out by giving us these constant recurring words over and over again. And so I'll read to you what Rabbi Sacks says. He puts it very, very nicely. He says, creation itself is seen as a slow emergence of order from chaos. This as a... Oh, I was reading the wrong paragraph, sorry. He says, this too is a fundamental to Judaic worldview. Goodness is order. Notice the word tov keeps coming up in creation. This is good. When things are separate and they have a place, that's good. An act or a person or entity, evil is disorder. Evil is when things are messed up. They're chaotic. The world has no structure. An act or a person or entity in the wrong place. Someone doing the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. The word het, sin, comes from a verb to miss the mark. The word avera means to, equivalent to transgression, means to stray over the border. In other words, you're missing the spot. You're pushing the boundaries too far away. Many of the statutes that we have are not mixing things together. Notice how the Torah doesn't want us to mix things. Don't mix meat and milk. Don't mix wool and linen. Don't mix seeds together that are not meant to be planted together. Don't graft new fruits out of things. Don't try and mix things that are not supposed to. Things have to have a spot and a structure and an order. And so what he's saying over here is that the most fundamental boundary is the one created first, the difference between heaven and earth. Never before or since, except among religious cultures influenced by Judaism, has God been conceived in so radically transcendent a view. Notice how Avodah Zarah, what does Avodah Zarah always do? It tries to blend the gods and the humans, right? The Greeks. And then the Greek mythology is all about how the gods come down to the humans and the humans try to behave like gods, and they're all fighting with each other and they're kind of mixing each other, and the gods take over the man's territory and man tries to take over God's territory. There's no divide. There's only a mixture and a chaos that exists. Judaism believes in structure and order and separation. Things have a place. Things have a time. Things have a way of how they conduct themselves. And so what these men were trying to do in the Tower of Babel was to try and uproot all of that. That's why the rabbi said they're fighting against God. They're doing avodah zarah. They're doing idol worship. It may not have been idol worship as we know it, but they're trying to usurp God and put God on the bottom and put themselves out on the top. And the last thing is they want to make a name for themselves. That's what it means when they say na'aseh lanu shem. We're going to make a name for ourselves above God. What Bereshit, and this is the last point that I'll mention here, what Bereshit is all about is the name of God. Not the name of people, the name of God. Shet, one of the lineage that seems to bring up good things, his first child, he calls him Enosh, which becomes the name for human beings. Men take the name of Enosh. What does the Torah tell us about Enosh? As hu hal, he began, likro, to call out, Beshem Adonai, in the name of God. That's what Bereshit is all about. Human beings recognizing the name of God above them and obeying the word of God and understanding that if you recognize God's name, God will give you all of the good. Interesting, right after this story, we read the genealogy of a man whose name is Shem. One of Noah's children is Shem. Where do we come from? We come from Shem. We come from a person who's called name. What name is he talking about? The name of God. Our responsibility as the children of Shem. Why do you think Noah called his kid Shem? He called him Shem, hoping people would realize it's about name. It's about the name of God. Call out in the name of God. Recognize God. They don't get the message. Shem's children is Avraham. God says, okay, we have to change the plan. The world is not getting it. We're going to choose one person from these people to be the one who's going to call out in the name of God. And that's what Avraham does. He builds an eshel and he calls out in the name of God. He builds altars to call out in the name of God. Everything about Avraham is calling out in the name of God. So just to summarize some of the ideas we talked about, we mentioned about the difficulty of this parasha, trying to figure out what the sin was. We posited a couple of theories, some really good ideas. We talked about the Abarbanel's theory about maybe a critique against technology and advancing in ways that complicate our lives more than enhance them, or things that we don't need, extra luxuries. And then I think the kicker was the point of Shem, the idea of name and recognizing the name of God, as opposed to trying to make a name for ourselves to overcome God, allowing that separation between Shamayim and Aretz to be able to take hold and understand things have a place. And when they have that place, the world is in harmony and in peace with themselves. Any questions? Okay, great.
Thank you.